Everyone from a private to a general knew the party's secret police force operated with unchecked authority and brutality. The Gestapo had initially come to the airfield looking for Franz's superiors, unaware that Rudel and Schroer worked from Olympus. Impatient, the Gestapo asked around, and someone had pointed them to Billy.
"What did you get yourself into?"
Billy asked. Franz said he had done nothing wrong. He thought back and admitted he had snuck into the Colosseum on a leave in Rome, but nothing worse. Franz told Billy he would confront them. Even if he thought the party was bullshit, he never said it in the wrong company. Franz entered the shack with Billy behind him. Two Gestapo agents were waiting for him. They wore shoulder holsters, although they dressed like accountants in white shirts and ties. One was the rank equivalent of a captain, Kriminalinspektor, and the other was an enlisted man. The Gestapo captain ordered Billy to leave. Franz found himself alone with them. The captain said they were from a regional Gestapo office. The door to the shack swung open. Steinhoff, the commander of JG-77, entered. The Gestapo captain asked him to leave, but Steinhoff asked for the captain's rank.
"The last time I checked, a major outranks a captain," Steinhoff said.
Folding his arms, Steinhoff leaned against a wall behind Franz, his presence and dangling knight's cross adding weight to Franz's defense. Steinhoff and JG-77 had returned to Trapani a few days prior, on June 13th, to relieve JG-27, so the unit could begin to rotate home. Billy had found Steinhoff and summoned him to Franz's aid. Steinhoff had always hated the party, and had dealt with the Gestapo before. In Russia, they brought their Inquisition to his unit, then Fighter Wing 52, JG-52, to investigate the supposed Jewish backgrounds of a few of his pilots. Steinhoff had declined to assist them, and had said to the Gestapo leader, "You'll be lucky if you leave Russia alive." The man asked if the skies were that unsafe. Steinhoff said, "No, it's because you just made enemies of 40 fighter pilots who have never added a JU-52 to their victory list, and I think that's yours sitting on my runway." The Gestapo captain told Franz what he already knew from the newspapers. 3 months prior, they had captured the White Rose Group, an anti-party cell of students in Munich. The White Rose men and women were young intellectuals who had spread leaflets spurring opposition to the party. The arrest and execution of the White Rose Group had sparked a Gestapo witch hunt for anyone who had spoken out against the party in any manner at any time. With Steinhoff present, the Gestapo men behaved in an unusually restrained manner. The captain asked Franz if he knew any of the White Rose members and read the names of the young people involved. Franz told them he had never heard of such people, because he truthfully had not. The captain asked if Franz had followed the church sermons of Cardinal von Faulhaber, or Bishop von Galen, or any of the clergy who had spoken out against the party. Von Faulhaber and von Galen were leading anti-party voices in Germany. Franz said everyone had read the writings of von Faulhaber and von Galen. This reply made the Gestapo agents glare. Von Faulhaber had authored With Burning Concern in 1937, and in 1941, von Galen had spoken out so vehemently against the party and the Gestapo that the British had copied his sermons and dropped them from planes across Europe. German soldiers, civilians, and occupied peoples read them, including the future Pope John Paul II, who found a flyer in Krakow, Poland. On July 13, 1941, from the pulpit of St. Lambert's Church in Münster, von Galen had said, "None of us is safe, and may he know that he who is the most loyal and conscientious of citizens cannot be sure that he will not someday be deported from his home, deprived of his freedom, and locked up in the cellars and concentration camps of the Gestapo." The Gestapo captain reminded Franz to watch his words. Under the party's 1938 subversion of the war effort law, any words or actions that the Gestapo deemed as undermining military morale could be punished by death. This included speaking out against the party, or even saying that Germany was losing the war. The Gestapo had convicted the White Rose members under this subversion law,
and killed them by guillotine. The Gestapo assured Franz that they had evidence that his brother was connected to known traitors, and they had reason to suspect Franz was too. A flurry of memories rushed through Franz's mind. He remembered the "with burning concern" letters he had found in August's room, and his suspicions of August's wife, the cardinal's niece. Franz knew why the Gestapo agents were questioning him. Worse, they probably had good reason to connect him with people identified as traitors. Thinking quickly, Franz told the agents that his brother was long dead, and he, personally, had nothing to do with the clergy or the Catholic Church itself. "I was excommunicated long ago," he told them. Franz knew this was only partially true. He still had his faith. He just had been banned from participation in his church. Under Steinhoff's stare, the Gestapo agents accepted Franz's explanation. "They were finally convinced that I did not know anything, and they left. I never heard anything else about it," Franz would remember. After they had departed, Franz thanked Steinhoff, who nodded and departed as quietly as he had arrived. Franz knew Steinhoff had taken a great risk in siding with him. The man had never even asked if Franz was innocent or guilty. He had just waded into the fire. Franz vowed he would figure out exactly why the Gestapo had come looking for him, although he knew the answer lay close to home. 1 month later, July 30th, 1943, southern Italy. The sun rose across the Adriatic Sea as Franz, Willi, and their comrades gathered with their bags over their shoulders along the small Italian airfield of San Vito. They watched their mechanics walk the flight line. The mechanics carried gray cloth tarps. The group had fewer than half of its fighters remaining, just 17. At each fighter, two mechanics stopped and draped a tarp over the plane's canopy. The day before, with the swipe of his pen, newly promoted Major Ruddle had relinquished the planes to the Ace of Spades wing, JG-53. Franz and his comrades had tried to defend Sicily when the Allied invasion came 2 weeks prior, on July 9th, but had been driven away by endless waves of Allied fighters. Franz had been shot down for the first time by Spitfires, but not before bagging one as a victory. He had bailed out and landed behind friendly lines, but had lost his fourth fighter of the war. Before Franz and his comrades boarded the trucks that would take them to their train for home, some JG-53 pilots showed them a memo that their commander had issued them. It was from Reichsmarschall Goering, a teletype sent from Berlin. It was addressed to all fighter pilots of the Mediterranean, and read, "Together with the fighter pilots in France, Norway, and Russia, I can only regard you with contempt. I want an immediate improvement in fighting spirit. If this improvement is not forthcoming, flying personnel from the commander down must expect to be remanded to the ranks and transferred to the Eastern Front to serve on the ground. Goering, Reichsmarschall." When Ruddle came to say his goodbyes, he told Franz and his comrades that he was not going home with them. Instead, he was heading to Greece to oversee the formation of JG-27 with its new fourth group. Ruddle must have thrown Goering's angry memo in the trash, because he never issued it to his men. Ruddle knew Goering, the leader who wore a red toga at his home in the Alps and smoked from a huge porcelain pipe that touched the ground. Goering, the violent morphine addict who painted his fingernails. Goering, who recorded his rants against his pilots on records that he shipped to his men on the front lines so they could hear his rage. In Ruddle's eyes, the Allies weren't the enemy. They were merely the opponent. On that day, Ruddle knew who the enemy was. He resided in Berlin, and something had to be done about him. As Franz and his comrades rode the rails north, their spirits improved with each passing mile. From a knee, Willi led the others in singing songs to Italian girls in the cars around them. He had scored 24 victories in the campaign, the most of the group's three squadrons. Willi was certain his hometown would throw a party for him, his own Oktoberfest. Franz promised he would attend. Franz was in a mellow frame of mind. He had registered just two victories during the Sicilian campaign, bringing his total to 19, although he had downed other planes without witnesses. Leaving the Mediterranean alive after two bailouts and a crash into the sea was good enough for him. All he wanted was a sound night's sleep in Germany. At a train stop, Franz picked up a German army newspaper from an Italian paperboy. The headlines made his eyes open wide. Willy picked up a paper and became mesmerized. Another pilot grabbed a paper, then another did, until the whole platform was filled with pilots with their noses in papers. In northern Germany, British bombers were systematically incinerating the city of Hamburg with firebombs, night after night, while the Americans dropped iron bombs on the city's factories by day. The paper tried to put a heroic spin on the tragic news, calling a one-sided catastrophe the Battle of Hamburg. They refused to mention that the bombs had produced a 1,000-foot-high tornado of fire that had swirled and swallowed 8 square miles of the city. They neglected to describe that the tornado had melted the city's streets and sucked the air from bomb shelters, killing in 1 week 42,000 men, women, and children. Sir Arthur Harris, the leader of the British Bomber Command, considered the bombing of Hamburg as payback for the German Blitz bombing of British cities that had cost the lives of 40,000 Britons. Hitler's Minister of Armaments, Albert Speer, would write in his memoirs, "Hamburg had suffered the fate Hitler and Goering conceived for London in 1940. Hitler refused to ever visit Hamburg after it was destroyed." Franz and Willy looked up from their papers and at each other with dismay. In Africa and Sicily, they had fought for nothing, for meaningless sand and sea. Now, with the front lines over their own soil, it suddenly struck them. They were going home to fight for everything. 10. The Berlin Bear. 2 days later, August 1, 1943, Regensburg train station. When Franz jumped from the train, he saw other servicemen greeted by their sweethearts on the platform. But when they cleared out, no one stood waiting for him. He hired a driver to bring him home to Amberg. On the front steps of his home, he did a double take when his mother opened the door. Her hair had turned gray, and she seemed to have aged 20 years in the 5 months since he had last seen her. Franz knew the hardships of wartime life, of losing a son, and the poor quality of rationed food had done this to her. Franz's father was away, but Franz had expected this. The army had drafted his father to train horses. Due to fuel shortages, the army needed horses more than ever to pull equipment. Franz thought it ridiculous to call a 64-year-old World War I veteran back into service, but he knew his father had had no say in the matter. Franz's mother showed him a recent photo of his father, who also looked much older than Franz remembered. His father tried to hide this by cropping his hair high above his ears and trimming his mustache short. That night, as his mother drank her evening beer, Franz asked her why the Gestapo had come to question him. She said the Gestapo had come to see her, too, because of August's involvement in the anti-party movement. Asked about the personalities in Bavaria's anti-Nazi movement, Franz would remember, "I did not know any of those people, but my brother did know some of them to some degree. He was very anti-Nazi, as was my family. He had been one of the first anti-Nazis as a young man." Franz's mother suspected that his name had been found among old letters and correspondence of other suspects the Gestapo had recently captured. The fact that August was long dead did not matter, as the Gestapo investigated his next of kin. Franz shook his head in disbelief. He told his mother that August would have told him if he was involved. They shared everything.
"You were flying the world," Franz's mother said. "How do you know what he was doing?"
Franz admitted he had found the With Burning Concern letters in August's room, but said he was certain the letters had come from someone else.
"What makes you think he was afraid to take a stand, quietly?"
Franz's mother said.
"Because he was Air Force,"
Franz said.
"Did he have a choice?"
Franz's mother asked.
"Did your father? Did you?" Franz looked away.
They made your brother fight, Franz's mother said, but he was master of his own decisions.
A week later, the town of Wiesbaden, Western Germany. Franz, Willi, and the pilots of Squadron 6 clung to the fence of the Wiesbaden town pool as they watched adults and children laugh, shout, and dive into the cool waters. Franz and his comrades stood with towels around their necks in mismatched bathing trunks. Willi held a basket full of bottled beer. Franz and the others were sweating, but the pool manager shook his head and folded his arms. He said he had nothing against the pilots, but could not let them swim because they had brought their bear. He looked at Franz as he said this. Franz held the leash that encircled the neck of a 300-pound black bear named Bobby.
We need to take him swimming, Franz said to the manager. Look at him in that heavy coat. He's hotter than us.
Bobby panted, confirming Franz's sentiments. Germany was wrapped in a heat wave, the same one that had dried out Hamburg and made it burn from the bombing raids, unlike any city before.
He'll bite someone, the manager insisted.
But Franz and the others assured him that Bobby would not bite because he had been raised by pilots and loved people. Willi explained that Bobby was a gift from the Berlin Zoo to his squadron.
How do you know he can swim?
The manager asked. Franz promised him that Bobby swam at the zoo. The manager knew the pilots flew from the airfield just 2 miles east of town, so close it was almost an extension of the town. Wiesbaden had not yet been heavily bombed, and if it stayed that way, he knew it would be thanks to the young pilots before him. Some children came to the fence to see the bear. Franz let Bobby walk up to them. The children reeled back in fear. Franz promised them the bear did not bite.
He only licks.
One little boy stuck his fingers through the fence and squealed when Bobby nuzzled them. Seeing this, the manager laughed, shrugged, and from that day onward, the pilots and the Squadron 6 bear were allowed to swim. The pool water seemed to turn the pilots into kids again. They shouted to their friends before jumping from the diving board. Willi and others talked to girls at the pool's edge. They all smoked. A few pilots drank beer while floating on their backs in inner tubes. Bobby swam around as children laughed and paddled away from him. Everyone who encountered Bobby became a fan. Franz had met Bobby when he reported to the squadron. Before Franz arrived, Bobby lived in a pen at night. But then Franz saw him being bitten by flies, so Franz allowed Bobby to move into his apartment with him. As squadron commander, Willi authorized this. He wanted Franz to care for the squadron mascot so he could be free to chase girls. Caring for the bear gave Franz something to do while his leave, the 30-day gift of life from the Air Force, wound downward. Franz set his beer aside and scampered up the platform to the diving board. From the board, he whistled to Bobby, who followed him, gingerly climbing the same steps, paw after paw. Before Bobby could step onto the board, Franz ran and jumped, pulling his knees into a cannonball. Treading water, Franz looked up and saw Bobby gallop off the board. In a massive splash, Bobby landed a foot from Franz's head.
Bobby never cleared the landing zone before jumping, Franz would remember.
Willi and the others laughed when they realized Franz had almost been squashed. The pilots, their girls, and the townspeople applauded as Bobby swam, his nose in the air. The sight made Franz melancholy and put a thought in his mind.
How long can this last?
A week later, mid-August 1943. When Squadron 6 began combat operations, every day at dawn a truck would pick up Franz and his comrades at their apartments in Wiesbaden. During their commute, the truck would stop at a deli, where the men bought horse meat sausages and filled their canteens with coffee. Bobby always rode to work with them. The trucks carried them past the farm fields that surrounded the airstrip at odd angles, their crops planted in rows of varying colors that from the air appeared to zigzag and camouflage the airfield's one long runway. On most mornings, the ground was covered by a ghostly mist, a thin ground fog of frost that sparkled in the sun. Bobby always jumped from the truck first and ran ahead to the briefing room. Wiesbaden Airfield seemed new and clean. Straight white sidewalks lay between the tower and the squadron buildings. Fresh, leafy trees bordered the sidewalks. The hangars were spotless and gently curved around a half-moon of concrete where the squadron parked its planes. Even the 109s were factory-fresh G6 models. Each plane wore the latest camouflage scheme, with wavy, dark green paint on top so the fighters would blend in with Germany's forests if seen from above. The plane's bellies were painted white to meld with the clouds if seen from below. Willy had claimed Yellow 1, and Franz had taken Yellow 2. The pilots called the new G6 the Bulge, because the plane had bulging metal blisters on either side of its nose, just ahead of the cockpit. Behind the blisters were superchargers, added to help the fighters operate faster at higher altitudes. Every other day the routine was the same. Franz and his comrades would soar up to 36,000 feet above the earth to battle the four motors that flew from England. When the squadron was airborne, Bobby would stay with the mechanics, riding around in their trucks. When Franz and the others returned, the bear became excitable and would lean its mud-covered paws on them. During Billy's debriefings in the squadron room, when female Air Force orderlies walked past, Bobby would bolt after them because the swishing sound of their synthetic stockings drove him wild. Bobby would chase the women until they climbed onto tables screaming. Billy loved when Bobby did this because it allowed him to be a hero and rescue the women. Bobby was a light-hearted distraction from the harrowing new mission facing Franz and his comrades. They saw their job as simple, to stop the bombs from dropping and killing the German people. And never could Franz have imagined that such a simple mission would soon pit him against his nation. 11. The Farm Boy. Earlier that summer, low over West Virginia, United States. The B-17's olive drab paint blended with the lush green mountains as the bomber flew at 2,000 feet. The plane rattled as it bounced in the turbulence from warm air rising off the mountains. Two young men sat at the bomber's controls. They could have been mistaken for teenagers who had stolen the plane had they not been wearing olive flight suits with silver wings on their chests and garrison caps on their heads with radio headsets over top. The young men had opened the cockpit side windows, and their clothes flapped in the breeze. On their left shoulders sat the blue circular patch of the American Army Air Forces, a white star with a red center and bright yellow wings sprouting from it. The plane's pilot sat in the left seat. Although he was only 20 years old, he wore the gold bar of a second lieutenant on his tan shirt collar. His face was square, and his brown eyes gazed up beneath short, flat eyebrows. His name was Charlie Brown. Charlie's eyes looked worried, although a smile spanned his thin lips. He always looked this way, even when things were going well. His looks were ordinary, his build thin to average, but Charlie was a thinker. For his age, he was emotionally deep and quite happy to talk silently to himself, the best companion he had ever known. Charlie's smile reflected his rough and humble upbringing on a West Virginia farm, like those below his wings. Down there, he had milked the cows before school and lived without electricity. Down there, he had never missed a day of school and had worked as the janitor at the local elementary school every night. On the weekends, he had served in the National Guard to earn money for his family. After high school, Charlie had transferred to the full-time army, where he found himself behind the controls of a B-17. Charlie gripped the W-shaped control yoke, while his newly assigned co-pilot, in the right seat, ignored his yoke to study a map. Charlie's co-pilot wore gold-rimmed aviator sunglasses that looked small on his round, full face. He was a second lieutenant named Spencer Pinky Luke. Behind his glasses' green lenses, Pinky's eyes appeared small and closely set. Pinky was from Ward County, in desolate West Texas, where he had been a mechanic before the war. He and Charlie were still getting to know each other, but Pinky refused to say where he had picked up such an unflattering nickname. Charlie guessed it stemmed from Pinky having a goofy demeanor and growing up in hardened cowboy country. Somehow the name followed him to flight school. Pinky clicked a white button on the yoke's handhold to talk over the plane's intercom. His throat microphone, like a rubber collar, picked up his voice and beamed it to Charlie's earphones over the cacophony of aircraft noise. Pinky gave Charlie a new heading that would turn them away from their easterly course. Instead, they would head south, directly toward Charlie's hometown of Weston, West Virginia. The detour was Charlie's idea. The flight that day was the final mission of B-17 training school for him and Pinky. Their instructors at their base in Columbus, Ohio, had assigned their final training flight with one stipulation: stay in the air for 7 hours to simulate a mission over the Pacific or Germany. As a reward, they let the pilots plan the route. Charlie turned his B-17 toward the new heading. He had been flying for 5 hours already, but nervous energy kept him sharp. Through the cockpit side window, he watched the 50-foot wing tilt upward. Two massive, round, Wright Cyclone engines spun black propellers just feet from his face. Ahead, the B-17's nose looked stubby to Charlie, because most of the plane sat behind him. She was a B-17F model, 75 feet long, nose to tail. After this mission, Charlie would fly to Texas with Pinky to pick up the other 8 men of his crew. There, they would mount 11 machine guns in the bomber, turning her into a flying fortress. Until that day, Charlie liked to think of the gentle plane by her other nickname, the Queen of the Skies. Charlie leveled the bomber with the horizon. Through his windshield, he saw the West Fork River gleaming in the sun. He knew the river's bends would lead him home. Charlie's eyebrows lifted when he looked west of the river and out Pinky's window. There, a collection of lifeless green barns bordered a grass airstrip. "That's the state 4-H camp," Charlie told Pinky. "Beyond it is the airstrip where I took my first airplane ride." Charlie explained that when he was young, a Ford trimotor airplane stopped there while touring the country, offering rides for a fee. He lacked the money to buy a ride, but the pilots took sympathy and made him a deal. If he washed the plane, they would pay him with a free flight.
"Is that how you got hooked on flying?" Pinky asked.
"Not quite," Charlie said. He told Pinky that he had originally been a soldier in the 7th Infantry Division at Fort Ord in Monterey, California. As a form of self-improvement, he had entered the base's boxing tournament in the lightweight class.
"That's where I met the opponent who changed my life," Charlie said.
He told Pinky that a skinny old soldier had stepped into the ring to fight him, a man with gray hair and arms so spindly his boxing gloves looked cartoonish. Charlie said he had planned to go easy on the old-timer, to pull his punches, and had even smiled at the man to let him know he would not hurt him.
"The referee had barely blown the whistle when all of a sudden he slapped me upside the head 2 or 3 times," Charlie said. "I didn't even see his arms move."
Pinky looked unsure if he should laugh or groan.
"The old-timer was actually an old pro," Charlie said. "I knew then and there that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time."
Charlie told Pinky that the man had knocked him out of the fight in the first round, then visited him at his stool. The old-timer said something he would never forget.
"You're too nice a kid for this army. Check out the Air Corps."
Charlie turned to Pinky, grinning.
"I did check out the Air Corps, and he was right," Charlie said. "Flying fits my personality far better than fighting."
Pinky laughed. Charlie secretly knew that Pinky fashioned himself a fighter, although he was really the non-confrontational type. He had told Charlie that he wanted to fly fighters, and had only accepted B-17s with reluctance. Charlie thought bombers suited Pinky's personality too, but did not want to say so. A small town came into view, with buildings on both sides of the teal-colored river. Charlie banked the aircraft and orbited over a flat gray bridge. He told Pinky that he was looking at Weston, his hometown. Pinky looked intrigued. The town was tiny.
The bulk of its brick buildings sat east of the river, and none were larger than two stories. Charlie pointed out east of the town to the town's glassware factories, which he said made a third of the country's glassware. He showed Pinky the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum on the west side of the river. The asylum resembled a haunted mansion. Charlie said that during his stint in the National Guard, he had guarded patients there after the asylum caught fire and needed to be evacuated. Charlie tipped the bomber's right wing toward a gray bridge over the river that ran through town. Old men sat and fished from the bridge, hoping to catch bass hiding under its shade. "I was almost killed on that bridge down there," Charlie said. He told Pinky that he had been riding in a car driven by his older sister, one of his five older siblings, when another car hit them head-on. He had flown face-first into the dashboard and broken his nose badly. "That's why I get nosebleeds," Charlie said. Pinky nodded, having witnessed Charlie's nosebleed during high-altitude flights. Charlie knew he was lucky that Pinky had told no one about his nosebleeds, or else their instructors would have banned him from flying. In the town's center, Weston's citizens walked from their shops and homes to congregate in the streets and marvel at the sight of the world's most advanced aircraft circling their town. Children jumped and pointed, amazed that such a large airplane could fly. Steering the bomber south, Charlie told Pinky he had one last sight to show him. He followed the curving river several miles until veering east over farm fields. Charlie drew Pinky's attention forward. There, on Pinky's side of the plain, was a run-down house with a gray tin roof on a small farm.
"Is your family down there?"
Pinky asked as they flew past the farmhouse.
"Nope," Charlie said. "But that was my home for most of my life. We moved out after my mother died."
Charlie explained that he was 12 when his mother, Myrtle, had died from illness. She had been the family's guiding light. Her loss crippled his father, who fell into a depression, and they moved to a smaller house. It took years for his father to recover, but he did. While Charlie was in the army, his father was elected as the local justice of the peace. Charlie turned the bomber westward, back toward the river and on course for their base. Pinky asked Charlie if his dad was still living. Charlie said he was.
"Do you think he's ever seen you fly?" Pinky asked.
Charlie admitted he had no clue. He said he had tried calling his dad, but could not reach him. Secretly, Charlie wanted his father and everyone else in Weston to see him and know he was no longer the farm boy bringing in the cows, no longer the janitor scrubbing toilets, no longer a PFC in the back ranks of the local guard unit. He was a B-17 pilot. With an eager grin, Pinky asked,
"What do you think about buzzing the town?"
Charlie said it was a good idea and a bad one. They both were aware of the Army's rule that forbids flying beneath 1,500 feet over a city. But Charlie also knew Pinky had always wanted to fly a fighter plane, until the Air Corps shot down his dream. Despite carrying a grudge against the brass, Pinky never resented Charlie for sitting in the lucky seat. Charlie knew the town's layout like the back of his hand. He also knew if they flew fast enough, people would be unable to discern the call letters on the bomber's flanks. Without catching their letters, no one would be able to call the army and report them. Charlie rotated the control yoke to the right and steered the plane north, locking once again onto the river as a course. He smiled to Pinky and told him to close his eyes so he could deny witnessing anything illegal. Pinky jokingly held his hands over his eyes, just for a second, then leaned forward in his seat. With his right hand, Charlie pushed the four throttles forward. The bomber surged with power. The wind whipped faster through his side window, trying to swipe away his cap. Charlie pushed the control column forward, and the bomber dove toward the river, where he leveled off, just feet above the teal water. Outside Charlie's window, the trees on the riverbank blew past in a green blur. The bomber thundered over fishermen in their canoes, who ducked with terror. Without the weight of bombs or a crew, the bomber raced along at 250 miles per hour. Pinky smiled with delight at flying like a fighter would.
The control yoke vibrated in Charlie's hands. Ahead, he spotted his target, the flat gray bridge at the center of the town, where the old men fished. The fishermen must have seen the bomber racing toward them. They ran, shouting. Other citizens looked toward the bridge. One man had never left the sidewalk from the moment the bomber had first been heard overhead. He was a short man with gray hair, and his black judge's robe hung from his frail shoulders. He had been waiting, hoping the bomber would reappear. He knew Weston had a lot of boys in the service, but only one was flying B-17s. He was Charlie's father, Charles Miller Brown, and he knew his son was looking down on him. Charlie jerked the yoke back, just enough to lift the bomber's nose above the bridge. The plane blasted over the bridge with a thunderous roar. The small brick town flashed past Pinky's window, and he waved at the town's startled residents. Outside Charlie's window, the asylum's white clock tower whipped by his window. "I was so low that I was level with the clock," Charlie would remember. Looking back, it was an incredibly stupid move. The force of the blast blew the river water over its banks and billowed the dust in Weston's dry streets.
"Who is that crazy son of a bitch?" a man in the street shouted while leaning around a corner to confirm that the bomber was gone.
Charlie's father heard this, clenched his fists, and walked up to the man.
"You can't talk about my son that way," he said.
The man shirked away. Charlie and Pinky were so busy looking over their shoulders at the effects of their low pass that when Charlie's eyes turned forward, they bulged with alarm. A towering green mass filled the bomber's windscreen. He had forgotten about the mountains north of town. The bomber's blistering speed made everything come closer more quickly. With both hands, Charlie and Pinky gripped their control yokes and pulled them toward their stomachs. The B-17 lifted skyward as the G-forces slid their maps and bags back along the floor. Only after the blue sky filled the windscreen did Charlie and Pinky push the yokes forward and level out. Together, they pulled the throttles back. Charlie breathed a sigh of relief. Pinky panted and swept beads of sweat from his forehead. Charlie turned the bomber west for Ohio and asked Pinky if he still wanted to fly fighters.
"I'm happy right where I am,"
Pinky chuckled. Charlie smiled in agreement. 12. The Quiet Ones. Several months later, September 1943, West Texas. Under the burning late-day sun, a rider sat atop a horse on a dry desert hilltop. His horse began to whine and stir. The rider grabbed his wide-brimmed hat and doubled his grip on the reins. The crusty soil below the horse's hooves reverberated. The rider looked upward as a B-17 thundered over him, its landing gear hanging down, its prop blast swirling the dust around him. Downhill from the rider, the bomber drifted onto the runway of the sprawling Army Air Base called Pyote Field, a place known through the Army Air Forces as Rattlesnake Bomber Base. The rider galloped away. Charlie would remember, it was a true cowboy town, and people on horseback used to come out to watch us fly as if they sensed some strange kinship between their horses and ours. The bomber's tires hit the runway with a chirp, chirp. The plane rolled and slowed. Its engines blew a cloud of tan dust from the white runway. The bomber taxied behind a seemingly endless line of B-17s parked wingtip to wingtip, opposite five hangars with elegantly arcing roofs. At the bomber's controls, Charlie leaned his head from his side window. Ground crewmen guided him with hand motions. The B-17 spun 90 degrees to park alongside the other bombers. Ground crewmen pulled up in two trucks with open beds. They parked one truck at the bomber's nose and another at its tail to pick up its crew. The mechanical ticking sound of hot metal echoed from beneath the plane's wings. A hatch swung down beneath the bomber's nose, the officer's quarters. A canvas flight bag fell to the ground, followed by a parachute in its olive-colored padded pack. An officer in a green flying suit, his sleeves rolled back, dropped from the hatch,
his heavy brown boots landing with a thud. He wore sunglasses and a crush cap, with a gold eagle on the front. His cap was crumpled like a veteran's, even though the man had not yet been in combat. He was Charlie's new navigator, Second Lieutenant Al Doc Sadock. Doc hailed from New York, although he looked like a Texan, with the face of the Marlboro man, a strong jaw, small nose, and permanent squint. Doc had been to college, unlike anyone else on the crew, and was well-spoken and sometimes cocky. He rode in the nose of the bomber with the bombardier, Second Lieutenant Robert Andy Andrews, who dropped to the ground next. Andy was a lanky kid from Alabama, with a narrow face, pointy ears, and slender dark eyes that sloped downward, giving him an analytical look. He followed Doc everywhere, although the two could not have been more different. Andy spoke with a soft southern drawl, never drank and never swore. Doc spoke with a Yankee twang and did not mind drinking and swearing. Andy was sensitive and Doc headstrong. But together in the bomber's nose, they made a balanced team. Charlie and Pinky were the last to swing from the hatch. At the rear of the bomber, Charlie's gunners carried their machine guns and handed them up to ground crewmen who stood in a nearby truck bed. Charlie had received his crew at Pyote 2 months earlier, and had flown training missions with them every day since. The mission that day had been like so many others. Charlie had followed Doc's course out to the base's 13,000-acre range, where Andy dropped practice bombs on white X's that had been painted on the desert floor. All the while, the plane's gunners shot at wooden targets that stood on bluffs. Charlie's top turret gunner, Sergeant Bertrand Frenchy Coulomb, approached him. Frenchy looked like a boxer, with eyebrows that hung low over his eyes, a small flat nose, and a square chin. Quiet and tough, Frenchy was from Massachusetts, but often broke into a Creole-style French accent to amuse the crew. He doubled as the bomber's flight engineer, the expert in the plane's vital systems. He was also the gunner's spokesman. Frenchy reported that the men were loaded up and ready to depart. Charlie gave his permission for them to leave. By the plane's nose, Doc and Andy waited in the truck. They helped Pinky aboard. Before Charlie could reach for a hand, a noise stopped him, the sputtering of engines twice as angry as those of his B-17. A green, cigar-shaped bomber on tricycle landing gear pulled up and parked alongside his B-17. The plane was a twin-engine B-26, the hot rod of all bombers. Charlie grinned. He had long wanted to fly a B-26. The B-26's massive four-blade prop wound to a halt. Charlie saw the short, stubby wings that made the B-26 dangerous to fly, but capable of fighter-like speed. Her pilots referred to the B-26 by a variety of nicknames: the Widowmaker, the Flying Prostitute, the B-Dash Crash, and the Baltimore Whore. The Army preferred to call her the Marauder. A pilot dropped from the B-26's belly. He wore a seat-pack parachute and an unusual white flight helmet and blue coveralls. Charlie walked toward the B-26 to talk with him, then stopped in his tracks, jaw-dropping. When the bomber's pilot removed his helmet, shoulder-length brown hair with curls tumbled forth. The pilot was a lady, and a pretty one. "It was a strange-looking pilot, a very attractive female," Charlie would remember. "It sort of shocked me, but it was a very pleasant shock." Charlie turned mid-step and scurried back to the truck. Leaning over the side railing, he asked his officers if they had seen what he had seen. They nodded eagerly. Charlie asked Pinky to come with him to talk to the girl. With a look of dread, Pinky shook his head. Charlie turned to Andy. "No way. I'll screw it up," Andy said, unblinking. Andy and Pinky looked to Doc. "Sure," Doc said to Charlie. Charlie faked a smile. He had never planned on asking Doc. Charlie had heard Doc tell stories about his girlfriends. It seemed he had a few on every base he visited. Sweat dripped from Charlie's cap as he approached the female pilot. At his side, Doc chewed a toothpick. The female pilot turned to greet them with a friendly smile on her bright red lips, Her face was oval, her nose turned upward, and her dark eyes almost disappeared as she squinted.
"That's a beautiful aircraft," Charlie said.
The girl asked Charlie and Doc if the B-17 was theirs. With a reluctant tone, Charlie said it was.
"There's nothing wrong with the fortress," the girl said cheerily.
Looking back at her plane, she added, "The Marauder is no prize. With its small wing surface, it has a tendency to drop out of the sky. On approach, you've got to land really hot." Charlie nodded, his eyes fixated on the enthusiasm that poured from her face.
"This is our skipper, Charlie Brown," Doc said, introducing Charlie.
Charlie chuckled, having forgotten such pleasantries. The girl wiped her hand on her flying suit, then shook Charlie's hand and Doc's. She introduced herself as Marjorie Ketchum. She was a WASP based out of Romulus Army Airfield in Detroit. Charlie said he had heard of the WASPs, the Women's Air Force Service Pilots. They were the girls who flew planes from factories to training units and deployment points to free up male pilots for combat. Marjorie was a graduate of the first WASP class, the Trailblazers. Charlie asked Marjorie what planes were her favorites. She said she flew whatever the ferry command gave her, but enjoyed big planes like C-47 transports and B-24 bombers.
"The best part about flying them," she said, "are the looks I get from my co-pilots when they discover they have to fly with a woman. Usually it's a stare that says, 'Oh my gosh, don't tell me she is my pilot.'"
Charlie was about to ask how long Marjorie had been flying when Doc cut in. He reminded Charlie that the crew was waiting and suggested that Charlie and Marjorie continue their chat at the officers' club. Charlie agreed and looked to Marjorie.
"I'd enjoy that," she said, smiling.
She and Charlie made plans to meet that night. As Charlie and Doc walked to the truck, Doc whispered,
"You did good, but you've got to hold something back to keep them coming back."
Charlie nodded, but had no idea what Doc was talking about. At the truck, Charlie climbed in first and gave Doc a hand up. Andy and Pinky tried to act like they had not been watching the two Casanovas. As the truck carried them away, Charlie looked back and saw Marjorie shoulder her parachute and walk toward a separate truck. Charlie could not stop smiling. He was very shy, and a date was a rare thing for him.
"Thanks, Doc," Charlie said.
Doc just gave Charlie a nod, then pulled his crush cap down over his eyes. Charlie and Marjorie sat at a table in the center of the dimly lit officers' club. Charlie wore his green dress blazer, and Marjorie a rich blue skirt and jacket with a gold pin affixed to either collar that spelled WASP. A row of pilots conversed loudly at the bar. Every time Charlie looked their way, he caught sets of eyes looking at Marjorie. Over drinks, Charlie told Marjorie how nice she looked. She said with a laugh that her uniform had cost her a fortune. Charlie looked confused.
"Doesn't the military equip you?"
he asked. Marjorie explained that WASPs were considered civil service employees and were required to buy their own uniforms.
"If I die in a crash, my fellow WASPs will have to pass the hat to pay for my funeral,"
Marjorie said.
"Since I'm outside of the military, my coffin can't even have an American flag on it."
Charlie shook his head in disbelief. Marjorie said that some people considered WASPs to be expendable.
"When I pick up a plane from a factory, it's supposed to have been checked out and flown for 15 minutes by a test pilot," she said. "But due to the high volume of aircraft production, some test pilots just run the plane for 15 minutes on the ground and log that as flight time. When we fly a new plane, often it's for the very first time."
Marjorie asked Charlie about himself, how old he was and where he was from. He said he was from Weston and told a white lie, that he was 24. Marjorie groaned and said she was 25. Charlie tried to look nonchalant. Really, he knew he could not tell her his true age, or she would walk out. He was 20. When he had been introduced to his crew, he had padded his age so his men would not panic at the notion of flying under a pilot so young. Now he had to stick to that story.
Charlie told Marjorie about his crew, whom he called his adopted family. He never made his men salute him on the ground, but in the air he made certain they knew who was in charge. The other crews call us the quiet ones, because we've never been caught doing anything out of line, Charlie said. Marjorie told Charlie about her pilot class. Each of the 23 girls had been a civilian pilot with an average of 1,000 hours of flight time before enlisting. Charlie and Marjorie lost track of time until a waiter interrupted them and handed Charlie a folded note. Marjorie looked at Charlie with concern. He read the note aloud. Crew in trouble. Need help. At the front door. Ecky. Ecky was his tail gunner. Charlie cursed his luck. Marjorie faked a smile and told him to go look after his men. Charlie reluctantly stood to leave. He knew Marjorie would be laying over at Piote for 3 more days, bringing the B-26's new crew up to speed on the plane before returning to her base. He asked her if she would meet him at the O Club the next night at the same time.
Yes, she said with a good-natured grin. If you get going.
Outside, under the stars, Charlie found Sergeant Hugh Ecky Eckenrode pacing back and forth. Ecky was the crew's shortest and quietest gunner, with a face that looked sad even when he was happy. Charlie and the rest of the crew loved Ecky, a simple kid from the hills of central Pennsylvania. Ecky apologized for spoiling Charlie's date, but said that two of the crew, Blackie and Russian, had gotten into a brawl in town. The MPs were questioning them and going to lock them up. Charlie suspected Ecky was involved because liquid drenched the front of his shirt and tie. Ecky led Charlie toward an idling jeep. Charlie's left waist gunner, Sergeant Loy Jennings, sat in the passenger's seat, his head leaned back. He hopped from the vehicle and saluted when Charlie arrived. Of the quiet ones, Jennings took the prize for silence. His face was square and his chin thin. His tiny lips seldom parted, but when they did, he spoke in a proper, polite manner, as if he were British. Charlie saw that Jennings's lip was bleeding, and knew he must have caught a stray punch, because Jennings was a teetotaler, and, like Ecky, the last person to fight back.
Lloyd, go get some ice on that, Charlie told Jennings as he steered him out of his way.
Jennings nodded and wandered off. Charlie jumped in the passenger's seat. Sergeant Dick Peschow, Charlie's radio operator, sat behind the wheel. Peschow was from Connecticut, and had a slender face and small but plump lips that defined his face.
Drive, Charlie ordered.
Peschow raced toward Piote, just minutes north of the field. Along the way, he tried to apologize for disturbing Charlie's date. Charlie cut him off.
Dick, I know you weren't involved, so don't bother.
Charlie knew Peschow was a techie from Connecticut who loved his radio so much he would have preferred to stay in the barracks examining its tubes and transistor chips rather than go hell-raising on the town. Piote resembled the set of a Western film. The main street held a dozen buildings, each separated by vast empty lots. The buildings all had covered walkways and railings where horses could be tied. Charlie imagined that cowboys once rode down the center of the street, shooting up the place. Now, servicemen stumbled between saloons, steadied by their buddies. Charlie spotted a bar with two MP jeeps parked out front at odd angles, as if they had been parked in a hurry. Charlie hopped out and told Ecky to stay, and Peschow to keep the jeep running. He bolted onto the porch outside the bar and stood aside as an MP barreled out the door, leading an airman who held a raw steak over half his face. A sobbing girl followed the injured man. Inside, Charlie hacked from the gray cloud of cigarette smoke that rickety fans pushed down from a high ceiling. He spotted two MPs questioning Blackie and Russian in a corner. Nearby, a flipped table rested on edge. Charlie was not surprised to see Blackie sitting there smirking, even as the MPs questioned him. Sergeant Sam Blackie Blackford was Charlie's ball turret gunner, a talkative Kentuckian whose face was always scrunched by a mischievous grin. Thanks to his backwoods upbringing, Blackie was a Davy Crockett type, as rough and tough as he was personable.
No one wanted Blackie's job, to operate the twin guns slung in a metal ball beneath the bomber's belly, except Blackie. But everyone wanted Blackie down there, because his dark eyes were the sharpest among the crew. Charlie pushed his way through the crowd and stepped cautiously over broken glass. When Blackie saw Charlie approaching, his eyes lit up. When Russian saw him coming, he leaned his head back against the wall and stared at the ceiling. Charlie knew Russian was better than such behavior, and Russian knew it too. Sergeant Alex Russian Yelisenko was a tall, burly kid from Pennsylvania whose Russian-looking features reflected his ancestry. A sharp, downturned nose, a strong chin, and big, balled-up cheeks. Russian looked like a grown man compared to the others, and was the crew's right waist gunner, probably because the waist was the only spot in the bomber big enough to hold him. The crew liked Russian because he was tough but kind. Charlie liked him because he was usually mature. Charlie approached the two uniformed MPs and tapped the senior-most MP, the one with the sergeant's stripes, on the shoulder. The MP and Charlie saluted each other. Standing ramrod straight, Charlie said in his most authoritative tone, "I'm placing these men under arrest." The MPs looked at each other confused, having never heard of a pilot apprehending his own crew. Before the MPs could object, Charlie shook a finger at Blackie and Russian, and in his most enraged tone snapped, "Exit this facility immediately!" Blackie and Russian quickly stood up and left the bar, while looking back to see if Charlie was joking. Turning to the MPs, Charlie said, "Thank you, gentlemen." He then spun and walked away. The MPs watched him leave as their minds tried to catch up to what had just transpired. Outside the bar, Charlie pushed Blackie and Russian toward the Jeep's back seat. Jumping into the passenger's seat, Charlie shouted to Peshaw, "Drive!" As Peshaw put the Jeep in gear, Charlie purposely did not look back, in case the MPs had changed their minds and followed him out. Blackie and Russian rode in silence, while Ecky held on to Russian to keep from falling out. During the drive, Charlie asked the men, "Was it over a girl?" He was waiting for them to say yes, and was prepared to pounce on them with a lecture about how their skirt chasing cost him his date.
"Yes and no,"
Blackie said. Charlie turned, perturbed, his glare asking for a straight story.
"Ecky went to the bar for a beer and made the mistake of standing near two drunks showing off for their girls,"
Blackie spouted.
"One of them spilled half his beer on Ecky, and he came back all wet."
Charlie looked to Ecky, who nodded.
"It wasn't that they spilled it on him," Russian said. "It was that they didn't apologize or buy Ecky a beer."
"So we made him apologize,"
Blackie said with a grin. Charlie turned forward to hide a smirk. He asked the men what happened to Jennings.
"Jennings helped us, sir," Russian said.
In fighting for one man, they were really sticking up for the entire crew's honor, Charlie would remember.
I couldn't condone that behavior and give them the wrong idea, but I was proud of them.
Charlie smiled in the darkness as the Jeep pulled through the airfield's gate. The perfect record of the quiet ones was still intact. Charlie and Marjorie met the next night and spent much of the ensuing 2 days together whenever Charlie was not flying. They grabbed lunch, went on walks, and met for drinks in the O Club.
"I was a gentleman and didn't try to get her in bed or anything like that," Charlie would remember. "It was really a pleasant, old-fashioned relationship."
On their last night together, Charlie walked Marjorie to her quarters. On the porch of her barracks, under a light that swarmed with bugs, Marjorie handed Charlie an empty matchbook. Looking inside, Charlie saw she had written her address at Romulus Army Airfield. She asked Charlie to write to her so they could see each other again someday. Charlie grinned and promised he would have his first letter in the mail before her wheels touched down in Detroit. They kissed, and Charlie walked away into the dark. A month later, late October 1943, Chicago. From the train car on the tracks of the train yard,
Charlie and his officers peered through a window. Eerie street lamps lined the deserted platform. Charlie and Pinky sat across from Doc and Andy. They all held Cokes in bottles. Their enlisted men sat in cars farther back on the tracks. In his pocket, Charlie carried his crew's orders to a staging camp in New Jersey called Camp Kilmer. From there, he and his officers assumed they would sail by ship to Europe. A whistle tooted. Steam rose up outside their window. The men knew the train was aiming eastward, but only when the train's pistons began pumping and its wheels cranking did they celebrate. "Europe!" they shouted, backslapping one another. No bomber crews wanted to go west to the Pacific, where too much water lay between tiny island airfields. Charlie in particular feared the Japanese after hearing stories of the atrocities they committed against captured airmen. Charlie and his crew debated their ultimate destination. Charlie hoped they were headed to England and to the unit from the newsreels, the 8th Air Force. Pinky hoped they were headed to the Mediterranean, where the Allies had recently invaded Italy.
"There's plenty of Germans to bomb there," Pinky said. "And the best part is, you don't have to fly over Germany to do it."
The men debated Italian wine versus English beer, London versus Salerno, Italian mud versus English fog. The debate abruptly ended when someone said, "What about Black Thursday?" The men grew silent. They had all heard the rumors leaking from bases in England. Only weeks prior, on Thursday, October 14th, the 8th Air Force had lost 60 bombers, 600 men, in one raid over Schweinfurt, Germany. It was the first battle that the 8th Air Force had acknowledged they lost.
"Okay, Italy it is,"
Charlie and his officers agreed, clanging bottles and cheers to the mud of the Mediterranean. 13. The Lives of Nine. 2 months later, December 20th, 1943, Central England. In his corner bunk at the end of a long metal hut, Charlie tossed and turned. From the cracks in the window's blackout paper, he guessed it was the middle of the night, maybe 3 a.m. He knew he needed to get back to sleep. His second combat run to Germany was a sunrise away. A week earlier, he had flown his first mission as a new member of the 379th Bomb Group. He had flown with another crew then, as co-pilot to a veteran pilot. This introductory mission was meant to acclimate a pilot to combat before he embarked over Germany with his own crew. During the mission, German fighters had passed above the formation Charlie flew in and beat up those behind him. The B-17 Charlie rode in bombed the submarine pens of the German port city of Bremen and came back without a scratch. The mission prompted Charlie to think, maybe this bombing gig isn't all that bad. Charlie pulled his blanket up to his chin. The room was freezing with an arched ceiling that seemed to trap the cold. Pinky snored in the bunk next to him, and other officers could be heard in their bunks throughout the hut. Engines belched in the distance as mechanics worked throughout the night to ensure that every plane was ready for the mission. Other men laughed as they walked by the hut, their voices traveling through the thin steel walls, probably the cooks on their way to fire up the mess hall. Charlie heard the squeaking brakes of trucks hauling bombs to their planes. Every sound kept Charlie from returning to sleep. The door to the hut creaked open. Footsteps followed. "Sir," a voice said, directed at Charlie. Charlie did not reply. "Sir," the voice said again. The orb of a flashlight shined against Charlie's closed eyes. A hand shook his shoulder. Charlie's eyes shot open. He squinted. The man was a sergeant tasked with waking up officers before a combat mission. Charlie sat upright and apologized for having overslept. The orderly told Charlie the time, 4:30 a.m. He reminded Charlie that breakfast was at 5 and the briefing at 6. The orderly roused Pinky from his slumber. Charlie swung his feet onto the cold concrete floor. The fire in the building's kerosene stove had died during the night. The bitter cold of the English winter made Charlie shiver. Snapping open the footlocker at the bottom of his cot,
He removed his toiletries and the uniform he had neatly folded the night before. He set his green boxer shorts on his bed and his blue bunny suit, a pair of long johns with wires snaking through its quilted pads. An electric plug dangled from the suit that a crewman would click into an outlet on the bomber. Alongside his suit, Charlie tossed his olive slacks and shirt. He set his belt and tie on the pile and slid his polished Oxford shoes from under his bed. He left his heavy flying pants and boots under his bunk to pick up later. Pinky greeted Charlie with a whisper. Charlie nervously faked a smile. After getting a mission under his belt, Charlie was no longer apprehensive of combat. But this time he knew he would be flying as the aircraft's commander. He was worried not of dying, but of messing up and taking 9 other men's lives with him. Another thought crept into his mind and propelled him forward. No man in the Army Air Forces was forced to fly in combat. He had volunteered for this. With that came extra pay and a sense of something intangible, pride. When Charlie reported to the 8th, he had landed himself in a unit that would lose more men in the war than the U.S. Marine Corps. Charlie grabbed a towel, his toiletries, and shuffled off to the showers in a building behind the hut. December 20th was a Monday. It was time to get to work. The air was stinging cold as Charlie and other airmen hurried through the darkness toward the mess hall, their hands tucked into pockets of their leather jackets. Some carried flashlights because the base was still blacked out. The flashlights' bobbing beams revealed curved Nissen huts, the prefabricated dwellings that looked like half-buried cans and served as barracks, offices, and storage